So we take up item number 7, speaking of Elk River. Update on the implementation of the Elk River TMDL, Mr. Chuck Striplin, Mr. Lance Lee, and it looks like Ms. Alita Mengelsdorf.
Yes.
It's all yours.
Great. Well, good afternoon, board. Nice to be back again on another TMDL. So this is an item on the Elk River TMDL, sediment TMDL. We made a promise to you when this board adopted the TMDL last year that we'd be back every year with an update on our implementation of it. And so this is that promised update. I have here with me today Dr. Lance Lay and Dr. Chuck Striplin. They've been busy working on the implementation of this TMDL. Lance has been monitoring and covering the Elk River Recovery Assessment, which you'll recall is a key analytical piece of our program of implementation, looking to help support whatever future remediation restoration work will be necessary in the impacted reach. And Chuck has been working on managing the Elk River Watershed Stewardship Program, which again, as you remember, is the umbrella program under which the implementation of this TMDL is undertaken, and in particular, the future remediation restoration activities. The way we'll divide this presentation is that I'll give you an update on the events on August 1st before the State Board related to approval of this TMDL. Then I'll turn it over to Lance, who will give you an update on the Elk River Recovery Assessment, and in particular, the development of a conceptual model which describes the various interactions throughout the watershed that the Recovery Assessment team has pieced together with the existing information. And then he will turn it over to Chuck, who will give you an update on the pilot projects that we have underway, and go over an update on the stewardship program. This is a fairly detailed and rich presentation. I think you'll be excited to hear all of the work that's gone on over this last year since the adoption of the TMDL. And you'll see a lot of new information that's especially come out of the recovery assessment. There'll be some natural breaks if you'd like to take a break or ask questions, in particular between each of our pieces of the presentation. So just to refresh everybody's memory, and especially for those who maybe have not been following closely with this project, this Regional Water Board adopted the Elk River Sediment TMDL for the Upper Elk River on May 12th of last year. We then, as staff at the Regional Board, are responsible for putting that item out for public review prior to the State Board then taking up the item and considering approval of the TMDL. So we put out the package associated with the State Board's action last December, so December of 2016. The public comment period closed January 17th of this year, and our initial intention was to have the item go before the State Board in February of this year. That date was postponed, and the hearing instead was held on August 1st. The primary reason that the hearing was postponed until August 1st was that the State Board staff had some questions about the TMDL itself and just needed to talk through each of the components of it and the requirements associated with it to ensure that they understood what the intentions were. And after several conversations, we concluded those discussions with an EO memo providing some non-substantive revisions to the action plan that essentially looked to clarify language where we had multiple terms referring to the same kinds of concepts. And in particular, there's two particular phrases that we sort of settled on as capturing the important key concepts associated with the zero load allocation. And those two phrases are control of all controllable water quality factors influencing the delivery of sediment. And the second one is the minimization and elimination of sediment sources. So those are the kind of key mechanisms by which the action plan directs attainment of the zero load allocation. So on August 1st, a team of us went to the State Board in Sacramento We gave a presentation before the State Board. There were public comments, and the end result was that the State Board approved the TMDL. They approved it via a resolution that State Board Council had drafted. And in that resolution are a few things I imagine you've covered in your closed session, and I will describe here for the rest of the people in the room. For those of you who haven't seen it, there should be a copy of the resolution out on in the lobby, as well as the EO memo and the updated TMDL action plan. So essentially what that resolution did was beyond what normally would be contained in adopting resolution was to describe first what the State Board's understandings were with respect to key elements of the TMDL. So they're putting down in writing how it was that they were interpreting the TMDL. And following that, they provide some direction to the regional board with respect to those understandings. So first, to cover their interpretation, this is what they've said, that the hill slope indicators and numeric targets apply, it's their interpretation that those apply throughout the discharger's area of ownership. And so not just on individual THPs as they come up for review and implementation, but throughout the ownership. And then there's a second set of understandings relative to the waste discharge requirements, in which they said that the WDR should incorporate specific provisions that implement all of the hill slope indicators and targets, unless the Regional Water Board can make specific findings as to why a given indicator isn't appropriate in a specific location. The WDR should also contain whatever additional specific provisions are necessary to ensure all anthropogenic discharges are minimized and eliminated. And the third is that WDRs should require the achievement of the zero load allocation by 2031, which is the end date of the TMDL, unless, of course, the TMDL is revised, which we offer in the action plan as a possibility if, in fact, we're successful in completing remediation and restoration activities in a shorter time frame and can demonstrate an expanded assimilative capacity. So those understandings were then translated into direction to the regional board, and the direction is as described here, that we are to review the WDRs for the two major landowners and revise them as necessary to make them consistent with the State Board's understandings, that we should include interim milestones and other earlier compliance requirements than the 2031 date so that we can demonstrate continued progress over time, and that should be the case to the maximum extent feasible. That we should complete our revisions expeditiously, but in no case no later than January 2019. And they requested that we provide a written update to the executive director every 6 months. And the first of those updates they wanted to see as an oral presentation before the State Board. And then the final thing that they included in the resolution was the basic acknowledgement that the full participation by all the stakeholders in the Watershed Stewardship Program is important to the success of this TMDL. So that concludes my update on the State Board's approval process. You'll recall that, as I said at the beginning, the TMDL Action Plan has three major components of its program implementation. The WDRs to control sediment discharge from the upper watershed, then an Elk River Recovery Assessment, which is a hydrodynamic sediment transport modeling exercise to evaluate feasible restoration activities in the impacted reach, and then a Watershed Stewardship Program to engage stakeholders in the design and permitting and implementation of restoration and other watershed health related activities. So I will turn it over to Lance, who is going to give you an update on the recovery assessment portion.
Okay. Chairman Oren, members of the board. So central to the recovery assessment's purpose is two questions. One is, what are the current geomorphic and hydraulic conditions in Elk River? And what combination of actions can recover beneficial uses and abate nuisance flooding? To answer these questions, the recovery assessment has the following task. It needs to revise and update existing data. It has to collect new topographic and hydraulic data, and develop a hydrodynamic model to test recovery scenarios. Additionally, a pilot remediation project is also included with the contract scope of work, which Chuck will go into detail later. The recovery assessment is funded by the State Water Board cleanup and abatement account with substantial cost shares from the Coastal Conservancy, Humboldt Redwood Company, or HRC, and the project contractors, which include Caltrout, Stillwater Sciences, and Northern Hydrology and Engineering. To date, the recovery assessment has completed revision of the existing hydrology and sediment data, mostly sourced from HRC. It also has also completed all data collection tasks, which include channel surveys, sediment sampling, and hydrologic monitoring. The recovery assessment has also convened the three technical advisory committee, or TAC, meetings. The purpose of the TAC is to give consensus-based constructive feedback to all recovery assessment work products. TAC membership is broad and diverse. It includes federal, state, local entities, including representatives from residents and the timber companies operating in Elk River. The first TAC meeting was to introduce the recovery assessment to the members and its goals. The second meeting covered the conceptual model, and the third meeting covered the hydrodynamics model scenarios. Now I will go into detail over the hydrodynamic and conceptual models. The model is based on the Environmental Fluid Dynamics Code, or EFDC, and it was it's open source and originally developed by the US EPA. On the left is a map of the model's geographic extent. The upper boundaries of the model are at the south at the confluence of South Fork and Tom Gulch, and at the confluence of Lake Creek and North Fork Elk River. At the lower boundary extends down to Humboldt Bay. And I'd also, And I also like to mention that data collection extends further into the confluence of North Fork and Bridge Creek. The total channel length being modeled is approximately 18 river miles, and if including the floodplain, the model is approximately 3.27 square miles or 2,100 acres. An important point to make is that because the lower boundary extends to Humboldt Bay, the recovery assessment is explicitly studying the lower watershed and its roles in impairments. Progress so far on the model is the completion of the model development and the model calibration. And calibration is the process by which the model is tuned or adjusted just such that it can simulate existing observations. The outputs from the model to assess recovery include flood inundation, magnitude and duration, suspended sediment concentrations and load, and topographic changes to the channel and floodplain. To test recovery, the model applies three scenarios, and they are based around two factors. One, sediment from the upper watershed, and this suite of recovery actions recommended by the contractors and approved by the TAC. Here are some results from the model calibration process. On the left, is a plot of water surface elevation on the vertical axis and time on the horizontal axis, and this depicts the December 2014 flood. In red are the data from HRC, and in blue are the data from the model. As you can see, it's an impressively good fit, and it shows that the model can properly simulate reality. And on the right is a plot of discharge versus water surface elevation. So discharge on a logarithmic scale is on the vertical axis, and on the horizontal axis is water surface elevation. The right plot shows four data sets. In gray are the model output data. In the blue circles are the data from HRC. In the red triangles are data from Salmon Forever, which is a nonprofit operating in Elk River. And in black, the black here, which is hard to see, is our data collected by the recovery assessment team. So the point of the right plot is that model is consistent with four different independent data sets. In total, the results give staff confidence that the modeling work is going well and that the model will meet TAC approval. So to better understand the model scenarios, we can frame them in the form of questions. So in the first scenario, the question asks is, will recovery occur without any intervention? This scenario makes no modification to the system, and the scenario is quite similar to the calibration run in the sense that it's simulating current conditions. So therefore, this scenario has completed, but the data analysis to answer the question is still pending. The second scenario asks, will recovery occur with the reduced sediment concentrations from the upper watershed alone? This scenario changes the sediment concentrations from the upper boundaries at North and South Fork Elk River. It is currently processing right now. The third scenario asks, will recovery occur with restoration actions alone? And the actions may include mechanical sediment removal, channel modification, vegetation removal, and other actions. Such a suite of actions reflects so-called desired watershed conditions that support beneficial uses and eliminates nuisance flooding. Scenario 3 has been proposed by the recovery assessment team, but will require TAC approval and discussion before being codified into the model. Now, while these three scenarios are in the current contract scope of work, the calibrated model can incorporate additional scenarios in any future study, including one that could combine scenario 2 and 3 by reducing sediment concentrations as well as implementing a suite of recovery actions. The realization of the reductions in implementation of the projects constituting scenario 2 and 3 are expected to be completed by 2031 per the TMDL action plan. So due to the highly technical nature of the recovery assessment and the need for implementation programs to synergize, the stakeholder-driven watershed stewardship program requested a more narrative interpretation of the recovery assessment's work. And this has come in the form of a conceptual model. The conceptual model interprets and summarizes data for a less technical audience by linking current landscape and hydrologic conditions to impairments to better inform recovery actions. The conceptual model was developed by Caltrout and its subcontractors and was funded by the State Water Boards through the Clean Water Act Section 205J grant funds. Here's a summary of the conceptual model, which is less a model in the sense that it's not a simulacrum of environmental processes, but a series of related concepts that build a narrative which help inform recovery actions in the hydrodynamic model scenarios. So starting on the left, you have processes or existing conditions derived from data collection efforts in the study reaches. These conditions include entrenched channels, levee and terrace formation, abrupt grain size decrease near the confluence, and rough riparian vegetation and fine debris. These processes lead to resulting effects, and these resulting effects can be understood as risk factors. They include disconnected floodplains, abrupt flow path changes, constricted hydraulics, and limited sediment routing and sorting. Now, if you combine these risk factors with a large sediment input such as that observed in the 1988 to 1997 sediment loading from the TMDL source analysis, this together leads to severe channel aggradation, which is the main driver of the of impairments, including increased nuisance flooding, increased turbidity, and aquatic habitat changes. Now I'll go through some important elements of the conceptual model. The following slides are lifted directly from the recovery assessment's presentation to the TAC, with annotations added to highlight key points. So here's a zoomed-in view of the project's geographic extent. The color scheme in this map depicts the surface height relative to the floodplain. So in green, in blue areas, the elevations there are lower than the average surrounding floodplain elevation. And in orange and red areas, their elevations are greater than the floodplain. The color scheme allows the comparison across the project area, which naturally has different elevations from when going inland. So for example, in the North Fork, you have a narrow floodplain constricted by steep valley topography, whereas in the Birdo Road area, there's a wide floodplain whose elevation is comparable to the channel bottom itself. The progression of landforms results in impairments at North Fork, Elk River Bridge, Elk River Court, Zanes Road Bridge, and Birdo Road Bridge. So this slide shows the valley longitudinal profile with elevation on the vertical axis and distance from the mouth on the horizontal axis. In orange, or rather, yeah, in orange is the main stem, and at the branch in green is the South Fork, and blue is the North Fork. The recovery assessment team wanted to point out an area in the profile which exhibits a convex curve or a convexity. This convexity can be described as a hump, so to speak, in the profile. The recovery assessment team believes that the convexity drives processes related to impairments such as valley incision and channel entrenchment. Such entrenchment is most pronounced in the middle area of the convexity, which is right where the confluence is. So on this plot, the vertical axis is valley incision, and the horizontal axis is distance from the mouth at Humboldt Bay. And so this value reflects the difference between these points here, which is the valley elevation and the riffle crest. The convexity finding was somewhat surprising, and the recovery assessment team believes it could be a result of numerous interacting factors, including sedimentation from the 1990s or earlier, as well as tectonic uplift or subsidence. In any case, the convexity feature is an area of continuing inquiry and research. So for this slide, so imagine if you're imagine a point of view on the river aligned with the direction of flow. This figure shows the progression of channel cross section as one goes downstream from the North and South Fork into the main stem. What's important to look at is the shape of the cross sections. So for the North Fork channel cross sections, you see a progressive entrenchment as you go downstream. And the recovery assessment team believes that this is due to the valley convexity and the hump in the profile. Staff's understanding is that when flow goes downstream and hits the hump, velocity decreases and the energy is transferred to the channel bottom in the wetted perimeter, leading to increased incision as well as backwater effects, especially as South and North Fork flows converge. This plot shows the changes in sediment grain size distribution. So on the vertical axis is grain size on a logarithmic scale, which is a scale on a factor of 10, and on the horizontal axis is the distance from the mouth. The solid lines are the main stem going into the North Fork, and after branching, this is the South Fork in a dashed line. So as you go upstream, the sediment coarsens, but as you reach the confluence, and you see an abrupt decrease, at least for North Fork, in sediment grain size. It's the expectation is that as you go upstream, the sediment coarsens with stream points, and the recovery assessment team believes that the deviation from this expectation is evidence of disrupted sediment transport and subsequent channel aggradation, especially if you consider rough riparian zones as a complicating factor. So dense vegetation on this left photograph, including invasive sedge, can anchor fine sediments, and fine woody debris on the right photograph constricts the channel, leading to a more severe flooding when the hydraulics are more constricted. So the previous slides kind of build a narrative in which the impact reaches and above, their impairments are heavily influenced by in-channel sediment-related processes. But downstream, the responsible processes shift into near channel and floodplain geomorphology. So this slide shows valley cross sections right below the confluence. So the red cross section, valley cross section, corresponds to MSR4 right here, where main stem reach 4, and the black cross section corresponds to this line right here. And you can see on this cross-section, there are terraces that form, and there are levees, the beginning of levee development here. And even further downstream, you have floodplains that are prone to abrupt formation of new channels during heavy storms in events called avulsions. So, for example, in this cross-section in green, which corresponds to this line right here, you have a floodplain which is as low, whose elevation is as low as the channel bottom. And so when water tops the levees, the flows goes down the floodplain instead of flowing laterally towards the channel, forming a new pathway. So between these two channels, water pools, and flooding can be more severe. Now, evidence for differences in processes that drive impairments in different parts of the watershed can be seen in the changes in bed elevation at different bridge locations. So these plots have bed elevation on the vertical axes, and on the horizontal axes is time from the 1940s to the current year. For North Fork and Zanes Road bridges, you see a jump in bed elevation in the 1990s, and right around the same time as the big sediment input, indicating a rapid channel aggradation. And because North Fork and Zanes Road bridges bracket steel bridge, indicated by the river mile here, the recovery assessment team infers that a similar jump occurred at Steel Bridge. However, at Birder Road Bridge, the increase in bed elevation is more gradual, indicating that the 1990s sediment inputs were not driving factors in aggregation relative to other locations. So taking a step back, this rather detailed discussion of processes is important because knowing what processes are dominant will dictate recovery actions. So for example, if sediment supply is a greater factor in some reaches, then reducing the supply would be more effective in initiating recovery. Whereas in reaches influenced by geomorphology, reducing sediment supply would not be as effective as, say, channel modification. And moreover, staff interpret these findings as supportive of the watershed delineation in the TMDL action plan, which sets the lower boundary of the Upper Elk River watershed at Birder Road, which is right where the transition between processes begin. As the board may recall, several public comments during the TMDL adoption process criticized the bifurcation of the watershed into upper and lower basins. But the recovery assessment has produced compelling science that has lessened the TMDL and has lessened the uncertainty around the TMDL and has significant implications for future recovery actions. So processes aside, the watershed is still impaired. This plot shows changes in channel cross-sectional area at the bridges as a percentage of the initial cross-section measurements. So on the vertical axis is the percentage of initial cross-sectional area, and on the horizontal axis is time. So with 100% as a reference, anything above 100% means that the cross-sectional area has increased, and that could be due to scouring. Anything below the 100% line, cross-sectional area is decreasing due to aggradation. So you can see at Steel Bridge, currently it's stable, the cross-sectional area is stable, but for other reaches, aggradation is still continuing, and aggradation is the main driver of impairments. So in summary, the key points for the conceptual model the key findings for the recovery assessment conceptual model and hydrodynamic model efforts is that, one, the progression of landforms with emphasis on the valley convexity controls channel geometry, sediment characteristics, and hydrodynamics. Two, the channel entrenchment and rough riparian zones disrupt fine sediment transport across the impacted reaches. Three, The large sediment load in the 1990s induced rapid channel aggradation and is the main culprit of the impairments and nuisance flooding in the impacted reaches. However, the degree of influence this episodic load has on impairments varies by watershed location. And four, the hydrodynamic model results are consistent with multiple independent data sets and corroborates findings from the conceptual model. As for the next steps, the contract deadline has been extended to May 2018, in part due to the long computation time by the model. For example, simulating 10 years of hydrology and sediment transport takes about an entire month of continuous computation. The pilot remediation project has yet to commence, although CEQA and permitting documentation is complete. Staff also expect one more tech meeting to discuss the completed scenario runs, and also to finalize the desired watershed conditions in order to run scenario three. The final report, which should be due in April 2018, should contain the modeling results, the data analysis, and data interpretation culminating in recommended recovery actions by REACH. Finally, the staff have reserved surface water ambient monitoring or SWAMP funds to address any data gaps. Such gaps include updating digital elevation data, as the most recent such data set was collected in 2004, as well as collecting new topography and water data similar to what was collected by the recovery assessment, that is cross-sections, sediment sampling, and hydrology. Overall, the SWAMP funds are intended to augment needs from the watershed stewardship program, in particular the needs of the Coordinated Science and Monitoring Workgroup. So before handing it to Chuck for the updates on the pilot project and stewardship program, I'd like to pause for any clarifying questions.
Any questions for staff at this time? Why don't we move on and have Chuck go ahead, and we'll come back again. Thank you, Lance.
Chairman Oren, members of the board. My name is Chuck Stripling from your staff in the Adaptive Watershed Management Unit. Large part of my role is managing the contracts and grant agreements associated with the Elk River Stewardship Program and the sediment remediation pilot projects. So today I'm going to describe for you the current status of the stewardship program as well as the status of the pilot projects currently underway in the impacted REACH. I'd like to briefly talk about the role of the pilot projects in this work. Really talk about why we're doing these. The pilot projects are an essential element of the road to recovery for the Elk River. They are, in essence, a series of on-the-ground experiments whose primary deliverable is learning for all parties involved. One of the most daunting challenges in trying to recover a resilient and functional Elk River is understanding how the system will respond to large-scale sediment remediation projects. One way to increase our ability to predict what those responses might be is to implement a small series of small-scale pilot projects. In the Elk, we've been fortunate enough to secure funding for three pilot projects, each in a different part of the impacted REACH, each with different hydrologic and geomorphic processes at play, and each employing different experimental approaches given the unique conditions and challenges at each location. These projects will give a variety of stakeholders a wealth of practical experience and data pertaining not only to the system's hydrodynamic responses to direct physical sediment remediation, but also with navigating the permitting environment, what's involved with property access agreements, and especially for property owners, what it's like to have major construction projects taking place on their property. Each project is relatively small in scope and scale, such that the risks to adjoining and downstream properties is minimized, prioritizing the safety of persons and property above all other concerns. Under contracts using AB 1492 funds and the Coastal Conservancy funds, Caltrout is implementing these pilot projects in a number of areas of the North Fork of the Elk River. Visible on this map are these projects. The red circle just indicated the Steel Bridge project on the Wrigley family property, just below the confluence of the North and South Forks of the Elk. Just upstream of the confluence, you can see the locations of the Elk River Flood Curve pilot site, which is right in here. Where was this thing? Right in here. And just upstream of that is the Wrigley Orchard pilot site. The other stream farther up, other possible site farther upstream was another proposed location, but the team ended up selecting the lower two sites for a number of reasons related to cost and logistics. The recovery assessment includes a task for the pilot sediment remediation project funded by the Coastal Conservancy with cost shares from HRC and Caltrout. The project involves the removal of a 2 to 5 foot berm constituting the road base and approaches to the steel bridge, including associated asphalt and vegetation, preventing free flow of floodwaters across a portion of the undeveloped floodplain. The expected outcome of this project is a minor but observable improvement in reducing flood severity, as the project is designed to alleviate hydraulic constriction at the bridge structure. Going back to the change in elevation plots Lance discussed, one question this pilot project may answer is whether the hydrodynamics and sediment transport at the steel bridge area are more consistent with those of the upper watershed or the lower watershed. This answer is pertinent because the Steel Bridge is located just downstream of the North and South Fork confluence and really right in the middle of the impacted reach. Design plans and CEQA compliance documentation for this project are complete, and construction should start imminently. We were hoping to report today that construction was underway, but I think a few more details on the access agreement are in the works. But I've been told by at least two parties today that they're pretty confident it's going to move forward soon. I also wanted to highlight that the good progress on this project owes a lot to the active cooperation from Humboldt Redwoods and the residents with the recovery assessment team. All parties involved have worked through a variety of complex issues, showing good faith and commitment not only to the successful outcome of the recovery assessment contract, but to the recovery of the Elk River itself. Just upstream of the confluence, we're in the process of scoping two additional pilot projects, one at the Elk River Flood Curve, the other at the Wrigley Orchard. Both areas experience frequent flooding and can impose significant hardships on the residents during peak flooding events. Scheduled to commence construction in June of next year, these two pilot projects together will treat almost 4,000 linear feet of the Elk's North Fork, removing at least 18,000 cubic yards of sediment. These projects are largely designed to provide tangible on-the-ground information to inform larger-scale sediment remediation projects in the Elk River. They will test the predictive ability of the recovery assessment's modeling tools. They will provide minor improvements to flood severity in the impacted reach. And they will evaluate the effectiveness of specific restoration techniques and provide project proponents with experience navigating the permit process for future projects in the watershed. To date, 30% design plans have been submitted, landowner access agreements have been negotiated, and the project team is currently preparing CEQA compliance documentation. Here again, we're seeing a high level of proactive coordination and collaboration between multiple residents and landowners, HRC, and Caltrout. Before moving on to the Watershed Stewardship Program, we wanted to entertain any comments or questions from the board.
Comments or questions at this time? Keep rolling, Chuck.
All right. So as we begin to discuss the stewardship program, I wanted to contextualize the work of the stewardship program in the overall scheme for the Elk River recovery. We now have a number of programmatic efforts in place to support the implementation of the Upper Elk River Sediment TMDL. As Lance described, the analytical findings and tools associated with the work of the recovery assessment will feed directly into the work of stewardship. The recovery assessment will provide an array of recommended recovery actions by reach. The stewardship work groups will take that information and work with local landowners to identify specific projects on specific parcels. Gleaning experience and information from the small-scale pilot projects I discussed, ultimately preparing a set of proposed large-scale sediment remediation actions, as well as possible infrastructure and water supply projects. In addition to the source control efforts handled largely by the WDR in the upper watershed in both ambient and project-specific monitoring programs, staff strongly believes that this coordinated planning, remediation, and monitoring framework for the Elk, really an adaptive management program, presents our best chance to achieve improvements to water quality and nuisance flooding in the basin. The stewardship program itself was initiated on a voluntary basis in late 2014. Stakeholders from the County of Humboldt, UC Cooperative Extension, NRCS, Caltrout, and the Regional Water Board designed a stewardship framework, which ultimately became a successful proposal to the State Water Board for 319H non-point source pollution funds. Beginning in December of 2014, the steering committee met more than 15 times. Two well-attended basin-wide public meetings were held, and several work group meetings were convened. Humboldt County delivered all required products for year one and ensured that their contractors were compensated for their time of work. As the board knows, Humboldt County ultimately decided no longer to serve in a lead role with this program. So we're in the process of moving the funds over to another entity to lead the work of stewardship in the Elk River going forward. We're currently working with our state board colleagues to effect that transition as quickly and smoothly as possible. I'd like to briefly talk about some of the progress made in the first year of a funded Elk stewardship program. This brochure was produced last year by the UC Cooperative Extension distributed to all residents, describes the nature and goals of the program, what residents might expect through participation in the effort, and some information about the participating organizations, funders, and sponsors. A stewardship program website was built and maintained by Cooperative Extension and will persist under a new lead entity when that contract is finalized. This website is a place where the public can view and download project documents, maps, meeting minutes, and agendas, and will be updated regularly throughout the project term. This brochure will also be updated and redistributed to reflect the new program structure. I mentioned earlier that two basin-wide public meetings were held. Both meetings were very well attended and took place in the watershed at the County Ag Building on Humboldt Hill. And the residents were not at all shy about asking questions and expressing their thoughts about it, their expectations for the program. These meetings were largely informational, with staff from all participating organizations presenting on the scope and schedule envisioned for the stewardship program, as well as information on the recovery assessment and the pilot projects. During each meeting, participants were polled on their sentiment towards the program and the likelihood of their continued participation. In addition to an overall high interest in participation, we're able to gauge the subject area interest of participants as will be distributed among the various work groups. As you can see on the graph on the right, there was a lot of interest in sediment remediation, but the majority of participants expressed an interest to involve themselves in more than one work group. Overall, more than 80% of the participants stated they were ready to get involved. And in closing, and to briefly summarize our presentation on the Elk River today, we're now operating under a state board-approved sediment TMDL for the Upper Elk River. Staff is currently working on the administrative record, which will then forward the TMDL to the Office of Administrative Law and then ultimately onto US EPA. The hydrodynamic and sediment transport model developed for the recovery assessment has been calibrated and scenarios are currently running. Three projects are on schedule and construction is imminent, if not underway soon, at the Steel Bridge. And stewardship activities continue while transition to a new lead entity is finalized. And with that, I'd like to entertain any questions.
Thanks, Chuck. Lance and Alita, thank you for the information. I'll start off here for a minute, Chuck. So let me ask you, one of these, I just did some rough math while we're talking here, and one of these assessment pilot projects here is talking about removing 18,000 cubic yards over about, would you say, 4,700 lineal feet?
About 4,000.
Yeah, so what, 4 yards per lineal foot are being removed from this section? Does that include vegetation as well? And shaping, this is a cross-sectional, is this through the whole longitudinal, the whole reach of that stream? How's that project work, by example?
Well, the specific designs are still being developed right now, but the idea is yes, to remove the constricting vegetation, to lay back the bed and banks where possible, basically to relieve a lot of that constriction. And then also to study if there's any deposition of sediment. So they're designed to be small scale, really experiments to understand what modifications to the bed, banks, and floodplain will be and how fast those impacts come back if they do.
At the same time, Chuck, can you give a flavor of the permitting requirements to do that?
Say that again?
Can you give a flavor of the permitting requirements to do that, both CEQA and the agency permitting to get and do that type of project? What does that look like? 404, 401, 1602?
Mitigated NAGDAX, yeah.
All that stuff?
Yep.
Is there an opportunity in these types of projects you foresee doing programmatic permitting on a bigger scale so that you don't have to go single file through projects here?
That is actually something that the stewardship program will evaluate. That's one of the things that we want to look at is looking at the whole constellation of projects, possible projects on the Elk and whether programmatic permits might be in line or if it would be more cost effective to go on a project-by-project basis if some of those projects are more straightforward than others. So that will be a stewardship activity, to be sure.
You know, one thing I said that upon adoption, and I said it through the process of Elk Rivers, I was really interested in the implementation and the doing on to get to this process here, and that this is these are important steps. I realize that, you know, the stewardship process, you know, I got to say you went over it, but the thing is, in reality, the stewardship bumped and had some problems, and it sounds like it's getting through those. I'm still, this is the main interest. This is the main interest. Alita, you talked about the state board adoption of TMDL. I went to that meeting as well as John Corbett, and the state board was very clear that that's where they want this to go. To have these types of projects coming through, you know, I was part of the original, me and Bill Massey, to get some of that money out of cleanup and abatement account to get this going on. And, you know, to see this start to roll, I think that this kind of project and application out here starts to build momentum. Certainly, I think that the use of the recovery model and the hydrodynamic model is key here because it informs in a big way. I don't know what kind of supercomputer you need to run to make that thing go shorter than 30 days, if you got to call NASA or something. But, you know, from the standpoint, it sounds like a burly model. I'm sure that thing is. At the same time, I think that there's learning that happens on these types of things. And certainly, I think, given the history, the social, resource and the monetary history out here of what happened and what has happened and continues to happen here, I feel like these types of projects and this type of momentum and doing this through this process builds then trust, is my hope, that it builds trust and momentum to go do this. You know, it is right, and Lance, you mentioned this, that, you know, we did not do a TMDL for the entire Elk River. We actually vested, the way I see it, is we vested a certain amount of the lower river into this process. And, in fact, this is outside of this board. This board does not control this recovery process. In effect, it's vested into the stewardship process, I believe. And in that, then, there's confidence, or there needs to be confidence, that that's, in fact, true, given the recent adoption of the TMDL, the comments that came out of that, the continued conditions that are here, and then the desire by, I think everybody wants the same thing here, to have a recovery river system that is acting as a predictable and, you know, enhanced river here. And so I like to hear about this stuff, and I'm very glad to hear that some of this happens. You know, a convexity? I got to go look that word up. But, from that standpoint, I get it. It's interesting. It's very interesting from a hydrodynamic standpoint, mm-hmm. right? That looks like it's, I mean, to go towards that, do either of these three pilot projects get in the convexity itself?
Well, the Steel Bridge project is just downstream of the confluence, and so it's really in the kind of the lower portion of the convexity. So that project could answer some questions, yes.
Yeah, very interesting. Thank you very much, guys. Questions? Mr. Corbett.
This may be premature, and it's okay to say it's premature, but my question for you is based upon your analysis under the modeling, were you able to determine any trends in the middle reach, either whole or in part, if any, and what were they?
So the final modeling results aren't out yet, but in conversations with the recovery assessment team, what we've discovered is that some parts of Elk River is naturally depositional, and
some parts are what I'm sorry.
Some parts of some reaches in Elk River are naturally depositional, but the rate at which it degrades is slow enough that beneficial uses can be supported. And so, as far as trends, I think that some recovery actions will be necessary to restore that state in which aggregation is slow enough to support beneficial uses. Does that try to answer your question, Board Member Corbett?
I mean, it might be helpful to bring back up the slide that shows the trends over time and shows that at some of those bridge locations, it's been at the Steel Bridge, it's been steady, mm-hmm. Which indicates no aggradation or scour, mm-hmm. but in other locations, it's showing ongoing aggradation.
Right, and just because there's no change in cross-sectional area, or rather there's no decrease, doesn't mean that there's no impairments. I mean, it has degraded. There is a hump. There's a sediment plug there, and that's causing the impairments.
I think for future presentations, it'd be extremely helpful if you could write up your analysis of what you think the numbers mean, would be real helpful for policymaking.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sorry, other questions or comments from the board? All right, we have some speaker cards. Let's go on to those. Thank you very much. So I have a number of speaker cards here. Noah Oppenheim is the first one, PCFFA. I have another one here, Christy Wigley. Yeah. Noah, I believe you requested additional time, and you were granted additional time. There was three requests for additional time. One is for Mr. Mike Miles. You had 7 minutes. Noah, you got the same. Christy Wigley, you have the same as well.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good afternoon, members of the board, Chair Norton, and thank you for the opportunity to provide these comments today. I'm Noah Oppenheim, the Executive Director of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations and the Institute for Fisheries Resources. I'm going to briefly review two of our members' testimony, which was provided to the State Board, and I believe staff have provided to you, which you should have copies in front of you now, from the August 1st hearing. At which the Upper Elk River TMDL was adopted and remanded to this board, and the waste discharge requirement was remanded. I'm going to outline some specific suggestions for bringing the WDRs up to the standards required in the technical analysis and by CEQA and the Clean Water Act.
No, can I stop you for 1 minute, please?
Please do.
We acknowledge, by the way, the action by the State Board. I want to, though, ask everybody today, we are not here today to talk about or debate the WDRs or what's to come with them. So I just want to ask that of everybody. This is not a hearing to debate the WDRs or what is to come. You're free to talk about the action by the State Board, but just realize that this today is a discussion on Elk River Recovery Assessment. You're free to give your presentation. I'm sorry for interrupting you. I just wanted to make that statement because we haven't noticed it. It's not a notice public hearing to talk about WDRs in any real sense of the word or to debate them.
Certainly. So I'll frame my comments then by stating that I'm attempting to both summarize the scope of the problem and to bring an additional component to your attention in order to address the needs of commercial salmon fishermen that I believe is a component of this restoration project. Vivian Hellowell, PCFFA's Watershed Conservation Director, has been representing us at the state and regional boards for years. She and others from our organization over the decades have provided you and other decision makers with the best information available about the decline of salmon fishing, due mostly to the persistent and systematic elimination of salmon freshwater spawning and rearing habitat and the co-option of cold water flows necessary for their survival. Despite decades of plain and simple science showing that these conditions threaten fish, habitat continues to be deleteriously impacted by external forces. Our industry has been stunned yet again this year with a zero fish allocation in the Klamath Management Zone, which is a 200-mile stretch of once productive coastal ocean that encompasses the Humboldt Bay. We've encouraged you and others to recognize what is to us an obvious need to protect what is left of salmonid critical habitat and to implement a robust and accelerated restoration, remediation, and recovery program in order to get back to a harvestable surplus of these now threatened and endangered stocks. As Ms. Hellowell stated at the August 1 hearing, we strongly disagree with the State Board's economic analysis that finds that allowing continued sediment discharge is necessary to accommodate important economic and social development in the area. When downstream economic enterprises are being buried in mud and with no recovery of the beneficial uses have even begun. Because, as the State Water Board staff stated in their response to the comments on page 19, quote, the evidence shows that both past and ongoing operations from the upstream landowners have led to aggradation and additional sediment loads in the impaired reaches of the Elk River, creating nuisance conditions and impairing beneficial uses, end quote. Stated plainly on page 3, quote, worsening pollution and nuisance are likely to continue until all controllable factors associated with timberland management activities are fully controlled and the impacted reach is remediated, end quote. As we speak, sediment from the Elk River is dumping into Humboldt Bay, where it is causing major problems, according to former Humboldt Bay agent for shipping, Mr. Leroy Zerling. He stated in a recent interview that, quote, the sediment coming from Elk River is phenomenal, and it is causing massive impacts to navigation in Humboldt Bay, end quote. A more detailed description of these conditions can be found in Ms. Hellowell's comments before the board, or you can learn from one of the fishermen whose livelihoods is impacted by them, PCFFA President Dave Bitts, who is here today and will be speaking later. Another one of our members, David Hellowell, is a lifetime commercial fisherman who docks at Woodley Island Marina in Humboldt Bay. He recently told the State Board about the thousands of dollars of damage caused to his boat and fishing business from the mud piling up in his slip. His boat now grounds out at low tide, literally sitting on top of the mud because the sediment is accreting. This has caused leaks, destroyed equipment, and caused several missing days of fishing. Now multiply this by several score of fishermen and you realize that this is a multi-million dollar problem affecting the livelihoods of an entire working waterfront. Mr. Hellowell recently asked the State Water Board, a legal team, a question that is worth repeating here. Is it lawful for the regional board to permit sediment discharge into Humboldt Bay that we have to pay for to remove? PCFFA believes that the answer is no. For this and many other reasons, we have supported a zero sediment load allocation. The lower reach of the Elk River has no assimilative capacity, and I believe that can be the briefest summary of the very comprehensive technical information we heard earlier. Additionally, the sensitive tidal areas in the river in Humboldt Bay, where juvenile salmon change to their ocean metabolism and adults return to spawn, adapting to fresh water, are adversely impacted by severe turbidity. The system is screaming that is choked by sediment. It is literally choking the livelihoods of PCFFA's members. Some of our suggestions to improve the implementation of this program include reinstating the 5-year sensitive subwatershed logging moratorium, ceasing winter operations, improving Class 2 stream protections to standards that are far more protective than those called for in the HCP, and we strongly recommend that the regional board consider implementing overall canopy retention criteria for erosion control. We believe that creative solutions to the timber industry's woes can be found that do not require additional sediment pollution. The Upper Elk River property, the most sensitive of critical habitat streams, already severely damaged, must be allowed to rest. Public money, including 319H grants, cleanup, and the abatement funds from the Water Board, and SB 1492 funds, is available that can provide jobs for timber workers while watersheds rest. The Habitat Conservation Plan relies on waste discharge rules and other prescriptive regulations to protect fish. The TMDL that has worked best in Garcia River has more prescriptive actions in its implementation plan. The Scott River TMDL, with the most voluntary actions, has not been working well for fish. And finally, the question has come up whether our organization will pull our petition out of abeyance to refer the waste discharge rule back to the State Board. The best answer we can give at this time is that it depends on what happens in the future. And as a result of these considerations and the collaborative process, we're encouraged to hear that the stewardship program is going to be reinitiated, and we encourage that that be done expeditiously. And we look forward to participating in those proceedings. And with that, I'll conclude. Thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you for your comments. Any questions for?
Yeah, I had one question. I heard for the first time in Vivian's testimony a reference as to the adequacy of the coho population in Elk River, but there was no references to that. If you could supply that to myself or the board, preferably, and staff, that would be appreciated.
Absolutely, Mr. Corbett, I can do that.
Thank you, Noah. Appreciate it. I have Mr. David Bitts, and he will be followed by Mike Miles. David, you got 3 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, board members, for the opportunity to speak here. My name is Dave Bitts. I am, as Noah mentioned, I'm the president of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association. I'm also a salmon and crab fisherman based in Eureka. I've been advised to leave my hat on in the interests of public decorum, so I apologize for that.
Don't worry about it.
I want to talk about the effects of Elk River mud on the commercial fishing fleet in Humboldt Bay. And it's not just Elk River mud. It's apparently the primary contributor, but there's also Freshwater Creek and Jacoby Creek that are helping to fill the bay with sediment. And the discharge of this mud to the ocean is permitted. Discharge into the bay is permitted, but removal of the mud from the bay to the ocean so far is not permitted. It's the same mud. The only difference is the tide as far as Elk River mud goes. When the tide is ebbing, The mud goes out the entrance and deposits in the ocean or along the channel. When the tide is flooding, the mud moves up the bay towards the Eureka Mooring Basin and Woodley Island Marina, and some of it settles out there. And it has become an existential threat to us because the Harbor District cannot get the permits to do an effective job of dredging. People are having to move their boats to the deep end of the marina. The city boat basin, substantial portions of it, are now completely unusable because there is an exposed mud flat where the slips are supposed to be at low water. We have pictures of this. I didn't bring them, but we can get them for you. If this situation continues, Eureka will cease to exist as a commercial fishing port. I mean, that's the stakes for us are totally existential. And so we would seek the board's endeavor to find, help us find a permitting solution as long as this mud continues to come into the bay. And I am encouraged that we seem to be making progress towards reducing the flow into the bay. But as long as that flow continues, we would ask the board to help us find a permitting solution that allows for the reasonable and cost-effective removal of this mud from the bay and letting it go to the ocean where it would all go anyway if only the tide would ebb all the time. Also, I would ask, we are contemplating trying to put together a meeting of representatives from the various permitting agencies. If we are able to do that, we would certainly invite the board to participate, to send perhaps a member and a staffer to that meeting, and we would hope that you would look kindly on our intent in keeping our working fishing port alive. Thank you.
Mr. John Corbett.
Oh, I just wanted to thank Mr. Bitz for appearing, and we're very honored, and thanks for your lifetime of effective fisheries protection. I think people that know you know how thorough and how long you've been working at it, and it's appreciated.
Thank you.
Mr. Bitz, can I ask you, so Army Corps, I assume, is the main permitting agency for dredging the bay, is that correct?
Well, it's one of five or six. There's
sure.
The Army Corps, there's the EPA, the Coastal Commission, and the Department of Fish and Wildlife are the principal agencies, but they're not the only agencies. This board has some, at least part of one finger in the pie somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where. And there are other agencies involved also.
Okay. I appreciate it. Do let us know if that type of meeting gets put together. You can actually liaison through Matt St. John.
You bet we will.
Make
yes.
such a request.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? I'm sorry. No. Mr. Mike Miles, you have 7 minutes, followed by Gary Rynearson.
Hey, good afternoon. For the record, Mike Miles with Humboldt River Company. And I won't need my full 7 minutes. I was pondering as I was driving over here that it's good to see who we're going to grow old with and as we go on in our lives. So we're back here at the regional level, and that's the proper place to handle these issues, and so I appreciate that. And certainly the professionalism of what we just saw, it gives me great hope, too, as well as the regarding the hydrodynamic modeling, the stewardship program. So that's optimistic. We're heading in the right direction. I think we're on the way home relative to dealing with the issues in the stream channel itself. The sediment loading, which Dr. Lee did point out, appeared to come primarily in the 90s as one of the things that was dominating and filled in that channel. The other bubble that's not shown on there, but that needs to be on there and that we're obviously working towards addressing, is channel management. And so there is a history of channel management in the Elk River watershed. It is a depositional area. And so when that channel management was terminated over concerns over salmonids, we believe that's when that led to kind of this continued aggradation and filling in. So So now, with greater education, hopefully we know how to manage that channel in a way that's both beneficial to fish as well as to the residents that are living there. Humboldt Railroad Company has demonstrated that we're a partnership in this and will continue to be that. I like to remind people we're the only people in this room that have removed over 300,000 cubic yards of sediment from the stream channels. And so we've done that, us and the predecessor landowner. So in terms of actual shovels working in this watershed and improving road and infrastructure conditions, that's something that we're proud of, and we'll continue that effort. So it's often, I do remind people that we need to do something. Well, we've been actively doing something for the last 15 to 20 years. The board's, state board's finding on the TMDLs, appreciate that, and it is what it is. It's a zero load allocation. There's no question about that. So we're looking forward to revisiting our report of waste discharge, getting back into our waste discharge requirements, making sure they're consistent with that finding. And hopefully we'll have the opportunity to provide you with a revisited ROWD that we can work off of and make sure that we have waste discharge requirements that implement the zero load requirements. I'll just speak quickly off from the heart there. We're trying to get together in a collaborative way to make some things, accomplish some things. We're constantly taking artillery fire about how we're a timber company and how we contribute sediment and whatnot. We just ask your staff, you board members, folks to come out into the woods and take a look at our operations. We believe they're the best in the state. We believe Elk River already has provided some of the best protection measures, if not the best in the country, if not the world, in terms of industrial timber management. Fly over on Google, you'll see the effects of selection silviculture. The woes of the timber company, I have no woes. I sleep very well at night that we're very good managers of that particular watershed, and we're going to help in the recovery of that watershed. The woes we have are people that continue to lead, or whether intentionally or unintentionally, provide what strikes me as misinformation about what are the causes of current conditions. So hopefully we can work with those folks better and have some better dialogue there and tease that out. Other than that, here just to say we're ready to reopen our RWD and take another look at the WDR requirements, make sure they meet the zero load allocation, and for the most part, think that we're on the long stretch home to actually doing something to get that lower channel in a place where it can increase its assimilative capacity and that the nuisance flooding is lessened. And actually, down closer to the estuary, actually, we improve fish habitat down there as well. So happy to answer any questions, but that's basically my statement right there.
Any comments or questions from Mike Miles? Mike, as I said, the state board's action the other day did have some direction in it. I went to that meeting. I saw you there, and trying to decipher then how to go forward. As I said before, at the start of this item, there has not been a decision about how to do that yet, and what to do. I expect we'll have that in the near future. Nothing's been set in stone, and nothing's been predetermined here. So. The state board made their decision and put it in writing, and words are words, and we're trying to figure out what to do next, and I expect we'll get there.
Okay.
So, and there is an end date out there that the state board put in their findings, so I expect we'll have something here pretty quick, and then inform, by the way, everybody, because it will be very, whatever happens, even if it's nothing, it's a public process.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Mr. Gary Rainierson. Followed by Jesse Noel. Gary, you got three of the best minutes of the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No problem. Gary Rainierson, Green Diamond Resource Company. Just to clarify, you asked for permitting, but as far as responsibility goes, the Army Corps of Engineers is responsible for the federal entrance channel. Interior is typically the Humboldt Bay folks that take care of that with the commission, the Harbor Commission. So.
Thank you, Gary.
And they actually have a dredge, but it says, as Mr. Bitz pointed out, they're having a hard time getting the permitting to use the dredge and where to put the spoils. So that's a problem for all of us, because we also have operations on the bay. One of the things, I too was in the room when the State Board approved this, and one of the things that Mike did point out that I think is missing from the discussion is, while there still appears to be sediment entering the system, although you can see recovery, that presentation would have been wonderful had we had it 2 years ago. And I understand it took a lot of time and money and effort to get it to where it is. But that was an extremely informative decision or presentation on the technical aspects of what's going on downstream. And I look forward to giving it to our technical folks and have them take a look at it and understand it better. But I think it does demonstrate why the TMDL should have been tied from the mouth to the headwaters, because the solutions are mostly downstream at this point. The best practices you can find in California are in Elk River, absolutely bar none. The way we do business in Elk River is at the top three standard deviations above what we do elsewhere. Not that they're bad practices elsewhere, but we take such immaculate care of how we operate in that drainage. What sediment may be occurring today that was demonstrated is probably from all of the work we've done in remediating the roads. From 2005 to 2016, we identified every controllable source of sediment on our property in Elk River, and we took care of it. We removed it. So that naturally is going to cause some turbidity as those areas that were treated come back. So I think that's probably the source. And I think during conversations we've had in many, many, many meetings, that has come up before. That may well be the source of that turbidity. One of the things I'd like to point out is that when you approved the TMDL, you included the statement, zero load allocation is necessarily conceptual since using current technology and techniques, no amount of land use restrictions can physically result in zero load of sediment. That's what this board approved. Unfortunately, the state board, when I listened to their discussion, went back and forth between management-related sediment versus natural, and that the controllable sediment from management was in fact controllable, and therefore a zero load allocation was acceptable. I don't know that fits what you intended, but it is what it is today. The number 8 in the board's order, where it actually gave some latitude to this board, gave latitude to the staff to implement the WDRs. When it said the indicators and numeric targets in Table 2 are designed to inform board action that can be incorporated into orders as appropriate and to the maximum extent feasible. That, unfortunately, was taken away in number 9 when the state board passed and says WDRs and the orders, for the two major landowners will also contain additional site-specific measures to ensure anthropogenic discharges of sediment are minimized and eliminated. In the absence of a future amendment to TMDL, all amendment based on the successful elimination of watershed steward program and expanding the sediment capacity and loading to impacted reaches to WDRs and any others will require the landowners to achieve zero load allocation for all anthropogenic discharges of sediment as soon as feasible, but no later in 2013. And actually, number 2 of that statement included, unless the regional board makes specific findings as why omitted hillside factors or numeric targets are not feasible, they will be implemented. So basically, 8 said, where feasible and appropriate, the state board in item 2 under number 9 said, if you're not going to implement all those, you've got to specifically tell us why. And I think that really puts a big burden back on staff and a big burden back on, frankly, and this board, is to understand what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate. Because there was flexibility intentionally built into Table 2. This order appears to take that away. So I look forward to understanding how that, when we move forward, and how that works. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Gary. Any comments, questions for Gary? As I said, Gary, you know, we're the findings, the resolution out of the state board, we're trying to decipher that as well.
Understood.
Those guys made a decision. They pushed it back our way. As Mike, as you said, it's back to us. So yep. Here we are, and we will go forward in one way or the other, to be determined.
And we also have the timetable that these need to be completed by January of 2019. So
you bet. And so time is of the essence, because, you know, we do things fast around here. And as it is, you know, we want to, as I said, you know, the first thing I think is to figure out a path forward. I think that has to come from this board working with staff and going forward then to build then the path to go forward from there.
We appreciate that. We look forward to work with you and staff to do that. Thank you.
Gary. Thank you. Mr. Jesse Noel, followed by Christy Wrigley.
They got copies already.
Mr. Wrigley gets also the 3 best minutes of the day. But before you start, or maybe as part of what you're doing, Jesse, could I ask, I started to look at this, and you might need to do some explaining, because please do. I'm trying to understand your graphs, and
sure.
Some of them are just a little bit hard to read, but that's
okay. That's Lindquist and Pauli off of the CDF website.
Okay.
And it regards the empirical growth and yield of redwood. And I've come to these meetings for 20 years, and I've never watched a forester explain, what did this landscape look like in 1986 when there was not a problem, and what does this forest cover look at like today, and then explain why this removal of vegetation is healing, a legacy impact. So I thought we should look at that.
Okay. No, I appreciate it. And I just didn't have any context for this, so I appreciate it.
I know you're all interested in empirical evidence. So.
You bet. Okay, you're on.
So I'm glad to hear that Mike Miles is interested in solving current conditions and understanding them better. But going back in the history of, how it was in 1986, by 1991, Pacific Meridian Report had come out, and Andy Baker, a water quality inspector, had observed and reported and explained that there were, to the board, that there were severe cumulative effects occurring from the logging that was going on. And yet, it's 26 years later now. We've had 26-year, each year more plans filed to accommodate economic activity. And what's happened is the river is infilled with sediment, and residents' lands have been filled, and our homes are increasingly threatened. So I think it's really important to look at that sample of 26 years of increased impacts, and in particular the 5 years where there was a logging moratorium on, actually not a logging moratorium, but a moratorium on new harvest. Following that period, there was a slump into bankruptcy with low harvest. And what we did observe, and Kate Sullivan's words of Pacific Lumber Company, was that there was scouring and recovery. And we started to see the empirical evidence of suspended sediment concentrations that had been adjusted for peak flow and antecedent rainfall precipitation were improving. Now that logging has started back up, the reverse is true. It's back into decline. So this page of what's before you is volume per acre. Average breast high age of redwood is on the x-axis, and hundreds of thousands of board feet or thousands of board feet are on the y-axis. And I've heard that HRC is proud that they have 40,000 board feet on average per acre is what they claim. So if you look down there at age 20 to 40 in the orange area, that's approximately the volume in board feet. But back in 1986, there was 80 to 120-year-old forest that was being cut, and it was closed canopy. It was very dense, even-age regeneration. And on the site 200, that in the 100-year period, the trees would grow to 200 feet. So you had a lot of vegetation for rainfall to fall through to become through fall. there was a lot there and a big blanket of warm air when a cold front came in that could absorb a lot of moisture and more room for wind that could dry out things. These are all things that have changed as a result of the economic model changing. And what happens is, of course, is that there's more peak flow runoff, and which causes more sediment to be discharged into the river. But I can see I'm already on a stop, and I have four more graphs to go through. So
I'll tell you what. Can you summarize those in a minute? I'll give you a little more time. I mean, can you summarize these other ones besides the first one?
Yes.
We got a few minutes.
Okay.
All right.
Good. So the second page, I believe, is handwritten in here. It didn't print out very well. Number of trees per acre in 1986 for site class 160, 180, and 200, you can see that there were 149 trees, 152 trees, 159 trees, I believe. And those were trees that were, you know, that stand was capable of growing in that 100-year period to 160-foot height, 180-foot height, 200-foot height. The HR selection is pointed out, is circled at the top, and had that been an even-age stand that they were selecting, it would have 251 trees, 298 trees, 342 trees, but each HRC's entries are allowed to be 10 years apart or 20 years apart under the HCP, as I recall. And so they're repeatedly, half the trees are taken out. And the basal area drops from, on the next page here, I believe it is. Jump two pages. To table 9, basal area per acre. You see 519, 606, and 699 basal area per acre in a 100-year-old stand, which would be 1986 on average. And then today, we know that HRC under selection takes it down to 75 basal area over their selection unit. And if they're doing group selection, they take it down to close to zero, but then the adjoining areas must be maintained at 150 to make up for that. So the difference between 75 to 150 and an average of 600, which was here in 1986 when we didn't have a peak flow and sediment problem, is quite striking. And it really, I think, I would encourage you to investigate that. I mean, if you don't believe that this actually happened in Elk River, you know, what Lindquist and Pally found, then go to they pay taxes on the, you know, the timber, and go see how many board feet they actually took out. And let's get that out in the public so we can see what the actual change in the environmental setting was and how successful that might be to recovering the beneficial uses and the destruction of private property and threats to lives and safety.
Okay. Can I ask you to just sum up one last summation statement?
I think that's a good place probably
Great.
To leave
it. Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
I have
John
a question.
Corbett.
Regarding canopy removal and the increased intensity of rain striking, do you think the peak wet weather flow model we have adequately captures that or not? And
no, I do not.
That'd be something I'd love to see in writing or some thought process to our staff to evaluate. And
well,
if
I could comment on it a little bit to, you know, direct them, I mean, give them a something they could look at. There's University of California, I believe it's Pascal, and foresters down there looked at multi-aged redwood and they the growth rate of it. And they found that, you know, you could grow about as much as if you clear cut, and in particular over few entries over long periods of time, you could get the same economic or exceed what you could get by clear cutting. And the trigger for harvest was leaf area index. So they tested or looked at two different triggers, one of 10 square feet of leaf per square foot of, you know, area, in, you know, and then also 12 square feet. And so they wouldn't harvest until that leaf area had grown back. And I think you could you could take that information and the methods that were used to gather it, which was how much sapwood does the tree have? They realized that was roughly proportionate to the amount of leaf area. So it's a fairly easy metric that you can measurement that you can make. And then they could compare that to these selection units, and you could actually see, well, how much leaf area is up there to intercept. It won't tell you what a, you know, how much the dead limbs in a 200-foot-tall tree and the bark and all that would intercept, but I think it needs to be looked at, so.
I had one other modeling question for you. You're probably one of them that takes the old gray hairs. The peak wet weather flow is really an indirect way of measuring increased intensity, which theoretically results in more sediment. We, for a long time, looked at a sediment budget model approach. If you had to do it over again, would you relook at that approach for modeling purposes? And
you know, if I were the person who got to say, well, here's what I would do. I would monitor the river, and I would determine what, how much suspended sediment could be in the river, and figure out a methodology like the one that Jack Lewis worked on for Salmon Forever and experimental design we've already put forward, and measure what comes out the tailpipe. Set up a time schedule for getting back, getting that SSC back to high quality waters. And then if the times, if the goals aren't met, the interim milestones, then it triggers a moratorium until they recover naturally. And I think that puts the onus on the discharger to do everything they can. And it makes it a lot easier for the staff and the taxpayer who pays for all these meetings and everything. So, does that answer, or?
Mr. Bedroy.
Just a technical question. The leaf area index, how is that measured? From the ground up, from the air down?
So if you if this is your square foot here, when you go up, there's 10 times, or their trigger, there would be 10 times the 1 foot of area. And, you know, leaves, how they can be on top of each other, they have more surface area than, you know, 1 square foot as you go up and measure it. I don't know if that was a very good answer, but probably wouldn't. But I think that's what how it is measured. They actually measured all those leaves and the surface area. It could collect water. Yes.
Great. Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Ms. Christie Wrigley. And that's the last speaker card I have, by the way. Yeah, Christy, okay. You're on. You have 7 minutes also, and I understand you have video.
I do, and I'm a bit nervous because I had car problems coming down. So I was just going to say I'm Christy Wrigley from Elk River, third generation farmer, surveyor, and I'd like to play the video first.
downstream, Elk River. Looking upstream, just south of the confluence.
Go ahead and bring the lights back up, please.
Okay, so that was Railroad Gulch as it drains into Elk River on the main stem. It's about 300 feet below the confluence. It's on my property known as the Red House. It's one of those watersheds that is extremely erodible and should not be logged in. It was proposed not to be logged in. And that amount of pollution has been shooting into the bay into the river for over a month now. And nothing but a report has been done that I'm aware of. So I would like to say that discharge is a privilege. Clean water is a right. We have not had clean water in Elk River since the late 1980s. It was recognized as being impaired by sediment from logging by water quality and other public trust agencies back in 1997. Despite many years of improved so-called better logging, Elk River has gotten worse. Better logging is just that, better logging. It does not ensure better water quality, as we have all seen by the last 20 years of continuously degrading conditions. There are many ongoing discharges, as seen by the video, that are not accounted for in the formulas. We see these discharges all winter and now all summer, along with overland flow, piping discharges off the upstream neighbors' timberlands. The uppermost neighbor or the timber man may think that the forest looks good, but he's making a living off it and he's looking at it to be logged. But and compared to what he knows back in the Maxam, what Maxam created, it does look good. But he does not know the functioning forest that Pacific Lumber had allowed Elk River watershed to recover to that Jesse was talking about, that we saw, we knew, and we experienced. Looking good to a forester and actually being a forest that functions properly by modulating runoff and delivering quality water for fish and people are two very different things. Knowledgeable residents who have studied the watershed for the last 20 years and longtime residents who have not only studied the river for the past 20 years, but know it by life experience are invaluable in the process of real river recovery, especially those of us with 60 plus years of experience as the first downstream resident and apple farmer below this industrial logging. We have an education that would equal any foresters. We have careers based on precise measurement, surveying. We have almost 10 years with the Salmon Forever Sediment Lab processing thousands of samples. We've cross-sectioned the river ad infinitum. Jesse has more experience measuring the river than I have. We need to be included in the drafting phase of what will be required to live up to the demands of the State Water Board to align the WDR to the zero sediment TMDL. asking those of us devastated by logging to now sacrifice more of our property to dig a wider waste ditch out of Elk River to accommodate the upstream neighbor's sediment pollution is not the way to recover a river or a watershed. It will not lead to quality water nor a healthy watershed. The silt that has been burying my fence post, in 2006, it was 16 to 18 inches out. In 2013, it was 6 inches out. And today, it may be 2 inches above the sediment. That silt has and is burying my fence post doesn't come from downstream. It comes from too much upstream logging. It was too much in 1997. Had you listened to us and really heard us and followed through, we would all be much better off. Logging of the last 20 years does continue to destroy our water, our property, our farms, and our fish. Involve us in the drafting phase of revising the WDR. So far, we have been more right about the river than anyone has. Our knowledge is the best empirical evidence available. Together, we could and can do a better job of controlling the sediment. I would like to say a couple of things that I hear over and over again I'd like to correct. Everybody mentions the HCP. Well, we know the HCP was based on the SYP, and the SYP was thrown out. So I'm never sure what kind of grounds the HCP has. Maybe it means a lot to timber and that analysis. But we also have a full report that says the HCP is not protective of water quality. It's on your website. Please read it. And I also would like to spar a little bit with Mike Miles and his how much sediment he's taken out of the system. I have quite a bit of that land that you see in the reach that is so heavily impacted where the residents live. And I have at least 5 feet of sediment for probably 3,000 linear feet of the river that I have taken out of the system before it went to the bay. So you're asking those of us that have been emotionally, physically hammered to now volunteer our time. Everybody else gets paid. We don't. Our property. And yet another experiment to make this world a better place, which we all want to do, but involve us. Not just in the stewards group. Involve us in the planning. Thank you.
Thank you, Christy. Any comments or questions?
You know, Mr. Noren, Chairman Norman, you assured both timber companies that you were there for them. I'd like to hear you assure us that you are there for us residents, too.
And can I ask for clarification from you, Christy Wrigley? What do you mean I was there for them? That I went to the state board meeting?
No, that that you would work with them towards a positive end for them. I should hope, I want to hear you do that for us too. I know it's implied, but it would be wonderful to hear it.
Fair enough, Christy. I'll tell you what, this, we are a, and I'll say it again, we are an open public agency. We have an obligation for open public dialogue, and you've always been a consistent voice in the Elk River process, and I always consider what you say. So your voice will be, I will tell you that I will listen to your voice and your words through the process, whatever. And by the way, I do not want to, and as we started this agenda item, I don't know what we're going to do with those WDRs. We have not set any path forward on those WDRs, so
yes.
I do not want to pre-characterize any piece of that right now. I do appreciate you coming. Thank you.
I just wanted to ask to be on the ground floor of that, not for any specific of the system, but to involve us. We do have extremely valuable information.
I agree. And the thing is, Christy, again, we have not talked to anybody about this.
Yes.
And we will figure a way forward. You, the residents, and the timber companies, and any other interested parties will be included within that process.
Yes, we have been included before, too. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, board members.
You bet. Any comments or questions? Okay, Elk River stewardship is obviously, and recovery is obviously, a very important piece of the Elk River TMDL process. There are things to do, obviously, going forward. One question I would have is future updates on this as it goes forward. Can I ask that of staff, of when is the next planned update for either the stewardship process, recovery, or whatever?
Well, the TMDL action plan includes a requirement that the staff provide annual updates. So at a minimum, it would be, you know, next late spring or summer.
Okay.
But if there are substantive findings and we feel that we need to share that with you, we'll either do that in the form of a written EO report article or as an information item.
And I seem to remember that there was a date of the hydrodynamic model and that type of process. I think, Lance, that was from you, April 2018? And is that a, can I ask you just to come up, because we're kind of getting a little bit squirrely here. From that standpoint, the expectation, Lance, is that's the publication and release of the hydrodynamic recovery model, or what is that specific?
So that's the final report for the recovery assessment contract. So that will cover the hydrodynamic model scenario runs, the desired watershed conditions, data reports, everything from that contract.
And at that time, too, Chuck, you had talked about the pilot studies. There would be one pilot study that starts in about 10 minutes, and then there's another one that's going to happen, two actually subsequent to that, and I believe one was next summer. Is that
June of 2018.
So at least one pilot project, assuming it's a go, would go.
One will hopefully have been completed by that time, and then we'll start the next two in June of 2018.
Okay. So my request then going forward is going, assuming that those timeframes work, that there be some type of update to this board soon thereafter of the publication of the final report that would include a report on the stewardship process.
And I would commit personally to the board members that as soon as we have a new stewardship contract in place, I will update the board as to what changes have been made, what the new scope looks like, what the new schedule, the deliverables. You'll get
of course,
all those details.
Of course, that goes through the EO to get to us, which is absolutely fine. And then we could look at schedule going forward. I know we have a potential agenda here somewhere for the next several months. We could look towards then a process of including some type of the next update. The TMDL doesn't bind us to a year. I think there would be logical updates to hit and milestones. Depending upon what happens with these WDRs, we could... You know, that is likely to be a parallel track, but nonetheless, there was a time frame built into the state board decision that time was of the essence. And so whatever happens with that happens, but I would like to just suggest that we have, without a firm commitment today, a request to come back and get an update once that report is done that you refer to, Lance, and then include and wrap in some of the pilot study projects.
Yes, sir.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.